And they were married and they had a dance, and they danced for 3 days and nights. I can, many times I've been told this story. So I think both families were pretty well thought of families, you know, pretty substantial. And my mother was supposed to be the most beautiful gal in Texas. Too bad it didn't rub off on some of the rest of us, isn't it?
I wouldn't say that. Okay, now. So, he was at the Spur Ranch then in 1909. He was married in 1913.
Yeah, Mama was 16. And Daddy was 10 years older than Mother, so he was 26 years old. He was no kid, you know. He also tells about the fine team of horses. I think Daddy must have been quite a connoisseur of horses, judging from the fact that he brought 2 racehorses to Albuquerque when he was 15 years old.
I wonder if there would be any record of that in the newspaper.
No.
You don't happen to know what he did when he got here?
Yeah.
Did he race the horses?
They raced the horses. I asked him if he won. He said they didn't. They didn't win very much, but they didn't lose very much. They made expenses. I'd be interested to know about this McCombs Hotel, where what it was.
Okay.
Now, you know, New Mexico was a territory in those days.
Well, not after 1912, though.
Yeah, but this was 1904 when he first came.
Oh, yeah.
Okay, so he and Mother were married in April 1913. And in September of 1913, he moved to a ranch near Roswell. And he worked for the F/ Ranch. And the man that owned that, his name was Headcombs. Something like that. Headcombs or Headcombs? I can find that out for you. Then in 1915, from the 1913 to 1915, he worked on shares on this F/ Ranch. And in 1915, he had built up his own herd. And he brought that herd north to Grants. Or Blue Water, just north of Grants. That was in 1915. And again he homesteaded at Blue Water. Shall I go on?
Yeah, go on.
Okay. Then in 1915, 16, 17, about 4 years he did this. And here again they were hit awfully hard by the drought. And Daddy says that he became very discouraged. And he decided he was just going to sell the whole mess, and he was going back to Spur. So he sold all his cattle, and he took Mother and, let's see, I suppose Ruth and Ruby and maybe Buford by that time. They were probably 13. Yeah, I think they probably had 3 children by that time. And he moved back to Spur, Texas. And he bought a wheat farm, and he put in a crop of wheat. And when he got ready to plow that crop of wheat, he said nothing but dust came up off the ground. So I put Mother and the children in the car, and he came back to Blue Water. And at that time, he bought in with a man named Stiles.
S-T-Y-L-E-S?
I don't know, Dan.
Or S-T-I-L-E-S, probably.
I don't know. S-T-I, I think. He bought an interest in with him. I think it was either half or just what, I'm not sure. So he'd evidently built up quite a little, I don't know how much money, but he'd had enough to buy the wheat farm and then, I mean, to buy his own herd and then to buy the wheat farm. And then he said he just drove off and left the farm. Whether he did or not, I don't know. But he maybe had a little working capital back. Couldn't say that. So then in 1921, he and this Mr. Stiles took this herd of cattle from Blue Water. Mr. Stiles was at Blue Water. And they moved them across from Blue Water, across Chaco Canyon. They didn't go to Chaco Canyon, they were up east of, or west of Chaco Canyon. To Bisti. Bisti lies in north of Farmington. And again they homesteaded. And right now, on the piece of land that he homesteaded, it's called the West Gallegos, there are 14 producing oil wells. bed. And then they really droughted out in about 1927. Now, when the bank went broke in Gallup, you know, during the Depression, Daddy had about $15,000 on deposit. That was a lot of money in those days. And it went under with the bank.
Well, I think he told me that story one time when we were driving by the bank.
Then in 1927 and in the spring of 1928, he shipped seven car loads of cattle to Denver. And he didn't even get enough money to pay the freight on. So at that point, you see, he was out. He was down for the count. And when he saw that this was going so badly, and I said to him, Daddy, when did you start first working with the Navajos? When did you first, you know, how did you get to be such a friend of these Navajos? And he used Navajos some on the ranches, you know. And Bistai is right out in the middle of the reservation, and so was Blue Water at that time. And they lived right out in the middle, and the Navajos were their neighbors. And I've heard Mother tell many stories. Mama was not as, Mother was not as friendly with the Navajos as Daddy. Mama always kind of was a little more reserved about them. She wasn't as comfortable with the Navajo people as Daddy was.
Did she learn to speak any of
No, she language? Didn't. Mm-mm.
Did your father?
Yes, I think Daddy can, I don't think, he says he can't, but he certainly understood. I don't know how much of it he could speak, but he knew whenever they were talking to him what they were talking about.
But phrases and gestures were enough.
Mm-hmm. Of course, he didn't speak fluent Navajo like Howard Wilson and some of the Indian traders. The only people that really spoke fluent Navajo were the Indian traders.
Yeah. For obvious reasons.
Yeah. Okay, so then in 1928, he went over to Fort Defiance. And he applied to the civil service then for a job. And then I think, then he took this meat packing assignment. Meat inspection, because it came first, you know. And here he is with quite a, by this time he had four children, and I was on the way. So then he took this assignment in Chicago. And whenever the family speaks of this assignment in Chicago, it was a black day in the Allen family. We were completely misplaced people in Chicago, just way out of our element. The older girls, when you talk to them, will tell you what a dreary, miserable, horrible time that was, because we were basically Western country people.
And what was that, a year's tour?
Well, I suppose it was supposed to be, but they were not there very long. Only about, only 3 or 4 months, I think. No, they were probably longer. Because I was 6 months old when we moved home. I doubt less than a year, somewhere between 9 and 10 months, I would guesstimate.
Now, right about 1928 or 29, the government put out quite a bit of information asking for Stockman to come and help them out. Do you happen to know whether your father's interest in working for the government came about from reading one of these brochures?
I don't know, but this is something we can ask him. Now, he was asked, he was put on, when he came back, he was given then he went to temporary work. Before he went to Chicago, he did temporary work on Doreen.
On Doreen.
Uh-huh.
What is Doreen?
Oh, I'm so glad you ask. That's syphilis among horses.
Is it really?
Yeah, it is.
Well, is it the name of the disease? The
name of the disease. Doreen work. Doreen, heavens, I.
Well, that's interesting because in the other tapes we have, I pondered over that word.
And Doreen.
I thought it was D-R-A-I-N. Do you know how to spell this?
I spelled it D-U-R-E-E-N-E, but I'm a notoriously bad speller, so don't take my spelling. Mr. Drew.
That, you think that's the medical term?
Right, I asked Daddy what it was just last night. Because I was going back over this, and I said to him, what does Dureen mean? He said it's venereal disease among horses. And he evidently knew quite a little bit about it. So he worked with the Indians on this before he went to Chicago. And then evidently this presidential appointment. Then that's what happened. While he was in Chicago, he was given a presidential appointment on the eradication of scab. That's how he came to Fort Defiance. He came to Fort Defiance on a presidential appointment on the eradication of scab. And I think right there is where his trouble started. Because he actually was not working for the Bureau of Indian Affairs. He was on a presidential appointment. What that amounts to, I'm not at all sure. He was sent to work directly with the Indians. And I think what they forgot to do was assign him a real boss, you know? And I don't think anybody really knew who his superior was.
This is extremely important, I think, because it may be one of the reasons why other people were antagonized by him, because he didn't really fit into a civil service niche.
He did not. He never fit into a civil service niche. He could have never gotten away with the things he got away with had he been either one or the other.
Now, was he on an appointment for the 25 years or so that he was there?
I don't think anybody ever really figured it out.
Did the appointment have to be renewed?
I don't know. We can ask him about that. I've told you the story, didn't I, about when he was at Crown Point, when he was going to water that livestock out there? Mm. Now this was probably in 1948. They were suffering a very bad drought at Crown Point. You see, Mother felt they were very tired of Daddy at Fort Defiance because he'd done just exactly what he pleased, you know, for a long time. And they never quite could, nobody could really quite put their finger on anything to really fire him in plain English. I think there were a lot of people who would love to have fired him. But they never could actually put their finger on anything concrete, you know, to do this. So, somehow or other, they came up with the idea that they would transfer him to Crown Point and hoping he would quit and leave. But Dad took this as quite a challenge because there was a lot of ranch land in the Crown Point area that Daddy wanted the tribe to buy for the tribe. There's two sides to this coin. Daddy wanted to buy the land from the white man and sell it to the tribe, and he made a commission on it. And he did. I mean, he sold a lot of that land there. He was making a commission on it for himself, but I think primarily his very first motivation was he knew how important it was to the tribe to have that land. So, I mean, he did two things. He made himself a little wealthier, and by the same time, he promoted the tribe to buy the land that he felt they should have. And I think if Daddy ever remembered for anything specifically, and if the smoke ever clears where this thing can be shown, if we can ever tie this all up so that this can be shown, I think Dad's greatest contribution to the Navajo was seeing that he bought more land. Land adjacent to the Navajo Reservation. Now in that checkerboard area around Crown Point, Daddy is directly responsible for all the land that the Navajo tribe bought. I'm not saying he didn't make a commission on it, because he did.
Well, was he doing this extra legally, do you think?
Sure. I think he did everything extra legally.
Well, we've got to remember one thing. It may be difficult to persuade your father to accept this fact, but both the law itself and the working of the law changes both in place and time, if you know what I mean. In other words, a law can be written for the whole country, but its application on the Navajo Reservation might be a great deal different than its application in Washington.
Well, I think what they were talking about, what they would have loved to have hung on him here was conflict of interest.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, right. Mm-hmm. Of course, speaking today of the difficulty of getting people, getting presidential appointments through the Senate, you know, this mm-hmm. is exactly the kind of thing that
right.
everybody is.